Welcome to the Healthy, Wealthy, and Smart podcast, where healthcare meets business, with your host, me, Dr. Karen Litzy. And just as a reminder, the information in this podcast is for entertainment purposes only and is not to be used as personalized medical advice. Enjoy the show. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Healthy, Wealthy, and Smart podcast. I am your host, Karen Litzy. And before we jump into today's episode, I want to give a huge shout out to our sponsor, Jane. They are an online clinic management software and EMR, of which I have been using since like 2017, 2018. The Jane team understands that getting started with a new software can be overwhelming, but you're not alone. To ensure the onboarding process goes smoothly, Jane offers a free data import, a personalized call to set up your account, and unlimited phone, email, and chat support. And with a transparent monthly subscription, you'll never be locked into a contract. And another thing they do is after you set up your account and you kind of you're starting to get going, you can set up another call with them and they will confirm and go through your account to make sure that everything is correct. So if you're interested in learning more, book a personalized demo at jane.app/switch. And if you decide to make the switch, don't forget to use the code LITZY1MO, that's LITZY, the number one MO, at sign up to receive a 1 month grace period on your new Jane account. And all that information is in the show notes. So wherever you're listening to right now, you can just go underneath, click on the link, and it'll take you right to jane.app/switch. You can set up your appointment. And hopefully you can switch to Jane for a much more, believe it or not, relaxing way to do your notes. And everyone, enjoy today's episode. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Healthy, Wealthy, and Smart podcast. I am your host, Dr. Karen Litzy, a physical therapist and owner of Karen Litzy Physical Therapy located in New York City. And today we are going to kind of pull the lens out and we're going to take a broader look at the state of physical therapy, and then we'll go a little bit more granular into the American Academy of Sports Physical Therapy. So I'm really happy to have as my guest today, Dr. Arielle Giordano. She is the Director of Clinical Services and Residency Training at the University of Delaware. She's a long-term active member of the Academy, the American Academy of Sports Physical Therapy, and is currently running for president-elect in this upcoming election, which will be March 11th to the 17th. So if you are a member of the American Academy of Sports Physical Therapy, listen up, make sure you vote, because we do want people to vote in these elections because they matter. So Arielle, welcome to the podcast. I'm happy to have you on.
Thank you very much, Karen.
So let's pull back for a little bit and give the listeners a little bit more info about you. So why your interest in sports physical therapy? Where did that come from and how did you get involved?
Okay, well, that's taken it back a while. I think like many of us that get into the sports side of things, I was a previous athlete. I was a gymnast in college. Most of us go through injuries. That's how we meet physical therapists. So I kind of went down that path as well. I actually knew at a very early age, this is what I wanted to do. I stuck with it, went to PT school, happened to go through an excellent sports residency program at the University of Delaware, which really focused me more in that sports and orthopedic realm. And then really found a passion for teaching and mentoring the next generation of students and physical therapists.
Amazing. And yes, that is often the case. I hear over and over again, physical therapists is, I was an athlete, or I was injured, or I had some sort of something when I was in high school, when I was younger, went to physical therapy, and there it is. So really, really common. And before we go, I have another question. So when we talk about the American Academy of Sports Physical Therapists, sometimes I feel like people might be a little intimidated because they may think, well, I don't work with professional athletes, or I'm not in collegiate sports as a physical therapist. So what do you say to those people who think that maybe they don't belong in the academy, or that even the sports research doesn't apply to them or their patient populations?
Right. I would say most of us are not in that space, right? Most of us, if you look at the actual percentages of physical therapists and or athletes in the professional or collegiate space, it's a real small, you know, piece of our practice. So I would say that most are looking at club athletes, recreational athletes, high school athletes, and or being active, right? Being fit. You know, I think a lot of the new movements with functional fitness, that's changing also how we're looking, and the areas of knowledge you need to have in biomechanics and injury prevention to be fit and healthy. So I think it covers a lot more people than we think it does.
Right, right. I agree. And because I remember years ago, I went to Sports Congress in Copenhagen. And I went myself and another therapist, Sarah Haig. Sarah Haig is known as being a pelvic health therapist. And people kept asking her, why are you going to a sports conference? You're a pelvic health therapist. And she's like, wait, but people not what do people who do sports not have pelvises? Like, this is what it should be. Like, we need a little bit more of that collaboration.
Yeah. And I think that's maybe you're getting to this question too, but I think that's where we are. It's kind of a pivotal point within our profession as to how can we work more together and less in silos. And, you know, I think in the past we've been a little bit more in our particular areas, but in order to do better for everyone, we need to crossover and have more collegial work together.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I also find that the research and the topics discussed in the Academy of Sports Physical Therapy, I can take that and extrapolate that to my patient population who maybe they're, you know, an older population, maybe they're over 65. But guess what? Like, you can still take from the research and apply it to your population with some variation, don't you think?
Absolutely. And I also think a lot of the people we're treating later, you know, they were active in their younger years, and they like to talk about that, and they like to do as much of that as they can. So, and I think if we improve on how we're treating them early on, we'll have better outcomes, you know, when they're older as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I couldn't agree more. Okay. So that was getting a little bit into it, into the weeds a little bit there, but let's pull it back and talk about the state of physical therapy overall. I love these topics. The listeners love these topics. So where do you think the role of physical therapy is fitting into our society? And then we'll talk about maybe where it can go.
Ooh, yeah. I think that's a big question, and it's really important right now. And I'm sure the APTA is spending a lot of time on this. I think we're a pivotal profession, not unlike others, but we're here to move people and move them safely and healthy. I think we're more in the prevention space than we've ever been, and preventing second injuries, you know, if the first has occurred. And this is all drastically expanded in my career's time. And how do we market ourselves better? How do we work with physicians and physician extenders better to understand chronic pain and to decrease chronic pain and know that we should be some of those first providers in that space? And that, you know, that goes into our athletes as well. What we need to do to get them on the field may be a little different than someone else who isn't a high level athlete, but there's, you know, there's consequences to some of the things we do. So we have to be prepared for that as well. So I think it's really pivotal. How are we going to work together to market ourselves and promote our profession in different ways that we haven't before? Where are we going to be actually treating patients, right? Are we going to be in a CVS or a Rite Aid, more emergency rooms, different spaces where we're seeing urgent care and people of need all the time?
Yeah, absolutely. And in your role, so Director of Clinical Services and Residency Training, What are you're seeing, obviously, more new grads. You're seeing, I'm making a general assumption here. So what are you getting from these younger clinicians that can maybe help us older clinicians be so that we could be a little more cohesive as a profession? Because you're sort of right in it, right? You're kind of straddling that.
Well, and it's interesting because I think when you've been in the career as long as I have, or maybe saying as old as I am, I think I'm going to relate to all of these people, and I've never really left the college atmosphere, but you know, I'm finally starting to see, wow, I don't exactly get what you guys are thinking when you're 20, you know, in your early 20s. And we're in academia, we're thinking about that all the time. Like the new learner, they're different, right? They learn differently than we do. Grit and resilience is different. What their expectations for pay and salary and how they want that are different. So there's a lot of different things, and understanding that is really important to be able to support them. And where our profession's going to go. I think they're really helping us understand health equity and treating in different spaces that have been underserved in years past, right? They're super passionate about those areas. And we probably were more in silos before that, where we need to branch out and we need to be in the community. We need to be able to touch more people. And I think that's something they've really brought to light, and they're really passionate about, that will change our profession.
Yeah, I remember when I first graduated so many years ago that I was like, well, I'll get a job like in a hospital or maybe a clinic, and that's where I'll work until I'll retire.
Right.
Because that was the thought back then. Like there was no go out into the community and really be a big figure in your community or start your own practice and do things differently. It was this was just what was expected. I don't know. Did you experience something similar?
I didn't think about anything but treating in a clinic with four walls. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess COVID had a few positives, right? But I think that also helped transition us to something different, right? We're not okay with being in four walls anymore, and that's okay. Some are online, you know, some are treating people. And I think we learned more about what people could do in their homes than ever when we started telehealth. It doesn't work for everyone. We understand that, but it did bring light to certain things that we were missing. And it also, you know, that age range is looking to do something different. Mm-hmm. And so that may be better. We may, our expansiveness in physical therapy may go other places because of that.
Yeah. And I think that the more places we can be, the more our profile as a profession is raised, right? So you had mentioned, you know, do we have a marketing problem or do we have a PR problem? Like, why is it that when people say I have back pain, they're not thinking chiropractor? Why are they always thinking chiropractor and not thinking PT, right? So where do you think, or what do you think we can do? And I'm not going to say as a profession, because that's so broad, and that's the APTA's job, right? But as an individual, what do you see the role as an individual physical therapist when it comes to marketing or public relations for the profession?
Oh, goodness. So I kind of think about this from a 30,000 foot perspective, as well as a director of a clinic. I still think, you know, some of the reasons we're not changing practice, we have a lot of variation out there. And how do we decrease that variation? You know, that can be accreditation issues, that can be, you know, oversight as far as programs at the DPT level, residency, fellowship, so on and so forth. But I also think knowledge translation is lacking. And, you know, we know the wonderful piece of literature that it takes 17 years to implement, you know, and we're able to do that with our students right away, but most other clinics can't. And so what are the barriers to being able to do that? Is it getting the literature? Is it synthesizing it? And now so much is coming out, right? From when we started as students and practitioners compared to now, you almost have to be in one area because you can't even barely keep up in that, right? So how do we improve knowledge translation so that, you know, we know what we're reading is worthwhile and we should be putting it into practice and then marketing that, not keeping it for yourself, but how do you make others do the same thing and be able to add this into their clinic in order to improve their outcomes? But that also comes with measuring. And if you don't measure these things, then insurances aren't going to change. Physicians aren't going to necessarily see us differently, right? We need better connections with them. We need to show data of things that we can do. And we need to change insurance reimbursement with that. So,
well, yeah, no, not small at all. Now, from your perspective in academia, that's, I think, where a lot of knowledge translation typically occurs. So how do you prepare those students or fellows or residents to then go out and be the
change agent?
Be the change agent. You know, what are you teaching students to better equip them to translate knowledge, whether it's to their patient or to a local reporter, a newspaper, TV, you know, you name it. Because it's a skill and it is hard.
It's very hard. And I feel like the students that are coming in now are so much brighter than I was when I was going into school. And they have so many more skills, but you still have to teach them the basics of physical therapy. And we're struggling, I think, in academia with professionalism and communication. And so many things have changed with social media and being on the web or your face is facing forward all the time, right? And so we didn't have to deal with those things on top of treating patients when I went to school. And so how do we deal with that now, as well as teach them the basic foundational skills? It's challenging. There isn't enough time necessarily to get them, you know, fully cooked before they're out and ready to go. So, you know, we're trying to implement them understanding what knowledge translation is. They're not ready to do that when they leave. We are trying to teach them the right questions to ask, right? Do your clinic have journal clubs? Are they using patient reported outcome measures? Are they actually measuring, you know, quad strength is one of my soapboxes. You know, are there certain things that they're doing that you could see that they're implementing things that are out there in the evidence-based world? And so I think our students are very knowledgeable in knowing that when they leave. And then hopefully building on that with more courses that are coming out in knowledge translation and, you know, taking the evidence and implementing it into your practice. It's also very hard to implement research into a clinic setting, right? The research environment is much cleaner than the clinic.
Absolutely. Much right? more controlled.
Exactly. So it is not the same. So even if you want to do that, it's not perfect, right? So hopefully we're teaching our students that, but it's very challenging to do that, right? And that's why we have residency and fellowships, to try to keep them moving up with that information. And then hopefully they're going out across the United States and the world to do some of those things that we're teaching.
Yeah. And this is where I think researchers need to do more after the publication of their research. And that's happening. You know, when you look at like BJSM or you look at JOSPT, now you have more and more researchers being a little more proactive with the knowledge translation that is necessary for the clinician. So instead of just saying, I published this, okay, it's in BJSM, it's in JOSPT, I'm done. No, no, no. So now what I'm really enjoying is going to different conferences and seeing poster presentations and seeing more infographics and seeing researchers getting on podcasts, or even I've seen researchers on local news. I've seen researchers in high-end mainstream publications like the New York Times or the Washington Post. And I enjoy seeing that, and I think there needs to be more of it. I think researchers really need to step into this space and get their information out there accurately in a way that can then be parroted by clinicians.
Agreed.
Right.
And I think with social media, we're in a place we never were in before, right?
Yeah,
I would think
totally.
this 17-year problem is changing. If you're reading and have the time to do all of this, right? And I think that's part of the issue. There's so much inundation now of information. And we don't quite have it down as to where the best information's coming from. So your sources are important, right? And I think it's improving. I also think they still need, and I see the researcher side, right? I was a co-author on this concussion clinical
Yeah.
practice guideline, right? These things are like birthing children.
It's a monster.
They're ginormous.
Yeah.
And when we were done, then some of the different academies and sections that were a part of it, they'll have different committees and task force that will put knowledge translation documents together, right? But then those documents just kind of go up on a website, right? Where is, and that's great. Now we have pieces. It's like that next step, but there needs to be three more steps. People need to be presenting on this material. They need to be really talking to clinicians, not just other researchers. How can they implement it? If more clinics had continuing ed courses, brought people in, how do we implement this into our clinic tomorrow? And it's a lot of work, right?
It's a lot of work, and I also feel like maybe it's not the sexy work, quote unquote,
Exactly.
right? So it's like everyone, when it comes to continuing education, like I would love to have a researcher come in, talk through, like you said, the concussion management tool, right? But instead, like people don't want to pay for that. Do you know what I'm saying? It's
Exactly.
like, oh, I'd rather have someone come in. This is, don't at me for this, anyone. But, you know, it's like, wouldn't dry needling be better? Or wouldn't Graston learning how to do that be better? Or some other, like,
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
tool, if
Yeah.
you will, versus, well, actually, if you learn this stuff, it will be so much more applicable to your patient populations, you know, and I think that what you just said, having researchers come in and talk to clinicians, is a much better use of time.
And we have a journal club coming up, and so this kind of resonates with me. And there was a newer article about the MASH trial, and it's in elderly low back pain. And so there's now, different groupings that can actually show, hey, you should really be doing hip mobilizations in this group, right? If they qualify in these different areas. But the tools they used in that study are a little hard to implement in our clinic, right? So we're trying to talk with the authors and have a good conversation about, we can't implement it at 100%, but I'd be really happy if we get to 85 or 90%, So what are some of the tools that would make it possible in our clinic? I
Right.
think we need to have more conversations that way.
Yeah, I think that's a great conversation to have. And as the clinician, I think you have to be okay with not being at 100% because you can't replicate what's in done in a study in a lab.
Right.
You know, like you were saying, like quad strength, I'm with you. I'm a big proponent of quad testing. I see people in their homes.
Right.
So my setup is going to look a little different. Granted, people have gyms in their building, so I'm able to set people up on a knee extension machine
Right.
at any rate. But it's going to be different than a lab.
Exactly.
And I have to be okay with that. And I explain that to the patient, and the patient's okay with that, right? We're trying to get some evidence on, you know, LSI evidence and just some general strength. Like, where are they in comparison to whatever bootstrapped benchmark situation it exists?
Yeah.
And they have to be okay with that. And I have to be okay with that. Because I think a lot of people may think, clinicians may think, well, I don't have that set up, so I guess I can't do it.
Right. Right.
And then I think you're missing out on some really valuable information, you know?
Which
But
gets us down to clinical decision making.
Right. So I always say, listen, if I carry around my, you know, my Mark 10 handheld dynamometer and a gigantic 8-foot chain which is on the subway in New York City. It's not like it's the easiest thing to do, you know, but I at least make sure that my setup is the same every time, right? So at least my intra-rater reliability is good.
I'm impressed.
It may not be exactly what the research is doing, but it for me, it helps my patient who's on his fourth ACL reconstruction on the same knee,
right,
to have some information and quite frankly, to hold him back from doing, because you're in that situation for a reason, you know? So I just encourage people to read the research and not just toss it because maybe their clinic isn't exactly like
absolutely
the lab.
And we have some nice things in our clinic and that's great. And our residents are like, oh, I want to be somewhere like this. I'm like, well, you're not going to be, right? So we're also trying to prepare you. And we tell our students, like we go through examples. Yeah, you had this in our clinic. You're not going to have that. So what are you going to do? Right.
Right.
And those are important conversations to have because sometimes then they don't know that next step to take and they kind of give up.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And I think that's a real shame. Because as a clinician, it sure is fun to get all the, well, maybe for some, for me, it sure is really fun to get all this information. And for the patient, it helps them understand where they are instead of me just being like, go ahead, push against my hand, be like, seems strong.
Right.
You know, that's not good.
Right.
That's not how it works. So anyway, I went down a rabbit hole on that. But I think it just puts a period to the end of the sentence that knowledge translation is important. And it takes everyone from the researchers to the clinicians to academia to, like you said, come out of those silos and let's work together and see how can we do this in the settings in which we work.
Yep. And I don't want to say we've been comfortable for a long time, but this raises discomfort, right? Mm-hmm. We need to get a little uncomfortable in order to keep moving forward. When you're comfortable, you know, you're going to regress to the mean.
Yeah. Well, of course, or below,
right.
Quite frankly.
Being generous here.
No, you don't have to be. I, it's my podcast. Or below. You could be generous. I don't have to be. Okay. So, you know, in talking about the state of physical therapy, from what I got from you is there's a lot of, we're moving in a really great direction. There's a lot of positive things happening. And the younger generation of PTs and me being like an older generation of PT, the more we can start to combine our forces, I think better for the whole profession, right? So right. Instead of the younger therapist saying, oh, those older therapists, they're out of touch, or the older therapist saying, oh, this generation, they don't want to work. You know, these are the things you hear.
Yep.
So
they'll be able to help us do things differently, right? Mm-hmm. And they're going to help me with technology.
Right. 100%. Yes, 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 for sure. Okay, so let's move into the Academy, the American Academy of Sports Physical Therapy. So you are running for president this year. So I guess the big question I have is why?
The good old why question. My why. So you'll see my statement out on social media, but I've been a part of the Academy for a really long time. Almost 20 years. And I've always done something in the Academy, different volunteer task force, so on and so forth. I feel like I'm strong in an organizational space. I'm very organized. I'm committed to doing this. I think we're at a pivotal point with our membership. It's been a little fractioned over the last couple years. And I think we're ready for something new. I would like to think a little larger. I think we've been, I know I kind of like the quote, flying by the seat of our pants for the past, for a little while. And we can't quite get caught up, right? We're a little behind in procedures and policies and things like that. And then communicating them, when we do have them, communicating them to the membership. The membership is not feeling heard. some membership are louder than others, right? And that happens all the time. But we need to become more cohesive, more organized. I would like to think through a strategic planning process so that, you know, even after this president, the next one will be ready to go and they don't have to start from scratch. I feel like we've been starting from kind of ground zero each president term. I think, you know, we've had some financial issues in the academy over the last couple of years. I do think that's turning around. I think that's very positive, but how can we keep that momentum moving while listening to the members, hearing what they want and need, and making a plan? I really think this plan is important, at least 3 to 5 years, and taking membership focus groups into account. Listening to them, that, you know, our three different, our early, middle, and later career individuals, how they learn, what they need from our website. And then looking at our conferences and our planning of things for the year, right? I think the current group is doing that as well. And it's, they haven't quite finished it yet. But we're looking at better conferences and programming and speakers. But also doing that in an organized fashion and making mm-hmm. sure everyone understands what that is, right? I would like to look at revenue generation with some of our content. We don't have a lot of content on the website or our learning center at this time. I'm a big proponent of residency and fellowships. I would love to grow residencies in sports residencies across the nation. And a lot of the barriers for residency, starting a residency, is the educational content and the curriculum that they need to have, right? Everyone thinks if you're located with an academic center, then, oh, great, you're going to have your curriculum. But it is really hard to put that together. I think with the people we have involved in the academy and others, this would bring in individuals that would want to try to come together for evidence-based content that could be for the person that wants to sit for their SCS exam or the people who want to go or join a residency program. Then that content can also be used for continuing ed, right? Also linking with membership outside of our academy, right? AOSSM, ESCA. I'm currently on a rehab meniscal consensus document that we're putting together. And it's really one of the first times that American physical therapists have been invited to the discussion. It's really exciting. So ESCA came to Mike Reinhold and asked, you know, from a academy perspective, who could start to get involved. There's going to be 20 plus, probably 30 plus physical therapists in the United States involved in this project by the time it gets published. We have our three groups with AOSSM on this document. So that's the first time we've had this international influence in something, and it's specific to rehab, right? And with surgery, which is really exciting. So I think that's a good connection. The current presidentship has, you know, the current group is really looking at improving these relationships. And I think we need to keep building from there. I'm trying to think of other.
I mean, that's a lot.
Yeah,
that's a lot. That's a daunting task. And when you're listening to members, what are the maybe like the broad topics that are most important to membership that, you know, they wish the academy did this?
Honestly, I would say the number one thing is communication.
Okay.
Right. I do think it's communication. I do think communication is happening behind the scenes. It doesn't always get out public facing sometimes. And with people changing and kind of starting from scratch, we've had multiple websites, multiple ways of communicating that's kind of taken away and given back. And, you know, and the financial constraints right now are limiting our communication as well. So without that, it will be hard to move forward in a cohesive fashion in getting information out to members, right?
Mm-hmm.
The website can't be the only way that we communicate. People aren't going to just go to the website. So,
right.
You know, we need better means of doing that. And that's definitely in the plan as well.
Nice. Yeah, that's it. I love to hear like this collaboration with other organizations, with physicians, and I often wonder why there's not more communication within the academies, within the APTA. Yeah. And I think that's changing too. I do think that's changing, which is a good thing. But maybe there are ways that we can collaborate across different academies within APTA.
Yeah. So it's interesting you say that, because you're absolutely right. I think a couple of years people started kind of branching out, right? You know, you start and you're like, oh, I'm a member of the sports academy, and I'm a member of sports and neuro. Like, mm-hmm. you know, athletes do have a brain, right?
Yeah.
And so our concussion CPG was one of the first that's actually a multi-academy product. So it was sports, pediatrics, geriatrics, and neurology. So kind of across the gamut there. And there were challenges with that, right? Like, each section in or academy usually has their own journal. Where do you publish? Where do you do these type of things? But also meetings, right? So you have trouble. You can't necessarily present at CSM in another academy if you're not a member of that section. And the way the SIGs have been set up in the past under the guidance of APTA has been challenging. You can't cross over. If we have a concussion SIG, ortho can't have a concussion SIG. And those, right? So once you own it, you know, that's it. So foot and ankle, we don't have foot and ankle. We have knee, they don't have knee.
Oh my gosh.
Right. And so a lot of people don't know that.
No, I didn't know that. That seems crazy.
Seems rather disjointed.
Yeah.
So some of those barriers are being questioned and broken down.
Uh-huh.
I think over the next couple of years, there will be some changes there that will allow us to really work better together.
Yeah.
You know, we would love to work with neuro and in the concussion SIG, but sure. You know, it's also costly for people to belong to every single thing. And when you're in a SIG and you're going to CSM, that really matters about which academy gets the money when you sign up and register,
right.
And everything like
right.
that.
Right. Yeah. CS, I think, well, that's a whole other conversation. We won't even go into that. But a CSM is a little more confusing than people think.
Yeah.
It's a little more involved than people think it is. Mm-hmm. But that's a whole other conversation that we'll save that for another time. Okay. So tell us more about the elections. I had mentioned they're from the 11th to the 17th. How can people vote? When, like, what's the deal?
Yes. Elections will come out and details will come out from Corey Martin from our executive office. They are uploading everything to the website right now. So the whole slate, all of their statements, their videos, all of that should be done in the next 24 hours. So by, you know, hopefully by Friday of this week, and then voting is from the 11th to the 17th. The platform that they're exactly coming out with, I don't think most of us know that yet. So that will come out from the Academy.
Perfect. And just so people know, as Ariel and I were talking ahead of the podcast, it's a big year.
It's a big year.
So president, vice president, treasurer, secretary, nominating committee.
Yes, ma'am.
Are all up for grabs and all need a vote. So I don't know what the behind the scenes looks like at the Academy of Sports Physical Therapy. I'm part of the private practice section. I can say there that it's certainly less than half of people actually vote for the people who are running your section. So if you are a member of the sports academy, I almost said section, old habits die hard, you know, go out and vote, right? Because then you have a say on all of the stuff that we talked about in this podcast.
Absolutely. You do have to be a member of the academy in mm-hmm. order to vote. Students cannot vote, unfortunately. Physical therapy assistants can vote if you're a member of the academy. It is really important. I think of any election you may take a part in, this one, every vote matters. You know, we had some votes at the business meeting. We were two votes different from side to side. So it's really, really important. To me, if this is the year you're going to vote, please do so.
Perfect. And okay, so as we wrap things up, and just so that people know, we'll have links to all of this. We're recording this ahead of time. So by the time this comes out, by the time you are listening to this on whatever platform you are listening on, we will have links to websites and things like that. So if you are a member, you can just click on and go. So as we wrap up, what are the big takeaways you want the audience to remember from today's conversation?
Yeah. I am a clinician scientist. I think I'm a really good organizer. I think the Academy is in a pivotal time and is ready for some change. I think I'm prepared to do that. I've been director of a clinic with many employees and research and students for 20 years. And I'm ready to help.
Perfect. All right. So I have one last question. So one that I ask everyone who comes on the podcast, and that's knowing where you are now in your life and career, what advice would you give to your 20-year-old self? So, you know, you're in physical therapy school. I assume you were in PT school at that time, right? So what advice would you give to that gal?
That's a really great question. Honestly, I would say work your butt off. I think it's important. I think it's important to work hard and understand what that takes. I do think that's what's helped me get me to where I am today. So.
Good advice. Good advice. Well, Ariel, thanks so much for coming on. Where can people find you if they've got questions or they just want to reach out and say hi? Where can they find you?
Yeah. Honestly, the easiest thing, because I'm usually working, is email aohunter@udell.edu. I'm also on Instagram and Twitter. I think you'll probably have those links.
Yes. Yes. We will have those links. Instagram at Ariel Hunter, Twitter at Ariel Giordano. So we will have both of those links so people can go straight to it. And if they have any questions, they can slide into your DMs.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And thank you again for coming on. Great conversation. I'm happy to have you here. And to everyone out there listening, thanks so much for tuning in. If you are a member of the Sports Academy, make sure you vote. And everyone have a great couple of days and stay healthy, wealthy, and smart. Thanks for listening. And don't forget to leave us your questions and comments at podcast.healthywealthysmart.com.